The four major schools of economics are Marxism, which is generally for government control, at least until the new utopia, Keynesianism, which is generally for government intervention, the Chicago School of Economics, which is generally for minimal intervention in the market and limited government, and the Austrian School of Economics, which is generally for no intervention in the market at all, hence total laissez-faire. In this video, I will be concentrating on the differences between the Austrian School and the Chicago School. Let's start with the Austrians. The founder of the school was Karl Menger, who was writing in the 1870s. He had two outstanding students, Eugene von Bawerk and Friedrich von Weiser, each of whom had their own outstanding students in Ludwig von Mises and F.A. Hayek, respectively. So that's who they are, but what is Austrian economics? The starting point is the study of purposeful human action. We all weigh up alternatives and make decisions upon which we act, but economics is not concerned with the psychology of such choices, but with which actions were chosen. Such actions are called demonstrated preference or revealed preference. If I offer you $10 or $100, whichever one you actually take is your demonstrated preference. This is purposeful action. The central insight of Austrian economics, then, is that everything that happens in an economy is driven by real human beings demonstrating their preferences through these purposeful actions. Hence, their description of the economy is said to be causal realist. The only ones making anything happen are people. The central tenet of Austrian economics is that value is subjective and that it is always subjective. You might prefer coffee and I might prefer tea. You might like coffee an awful lot, whereas I might like tea only marginally more than I like coffee. For Austrians, prices in the real economy are always based on these subjective preferences, which we inherently cannot measure. Indeed, your own preference for coffee might change over time. I didn't drink it when I was 17, but I do now, for example. For more on this, see my video, Pricing a Cup of Coffee. Austrians argue that other economists, despite claiming to believe that value is subjective, end up forgetting this when modelling prices in their hidden assumption that production costs determine prices. Austrians insist that production costs do not determine prices, only subjective preferences. Because we cannot know what people's subjective preferences and valuations of things are, Austrians reject the idea that economics can be a hard science, like, for example, physics. They argue you cannot predict what people may or may not do because human beings are not like stones, which react to conditions in predictable ways, and besides, you can never get constant variables in the real world anyway. Therefore, Austrians reject mathematical modelling in economics. And a final feature of Austrian economics is that they never forget the role of time, because humans must act in a world bound by time. Time is a constant feature of our economic affairs, which is often overlooked by other economists. This is important when considering such things as pricing, inflation, and the role of the entrepreneur, and I have videos on these topics if you're interested. The key Austrian contributions to economic theory have been marginal utility, which was advanced by Karl Menger and concerns the subjective theory of value I have already discussed. Imagine you are thirsty in a desert in the baking sun. What would you give for a glass of water? Now imagine you've just finished drinking a whole pint of water. What would you give for the next glass? I'd warrant it would be considerably less than you'd give if you were thirsty in the desert. Another key Austrian contribution, this time from Friedrich von Weiser, is the idea of opportunity cost, which is, simply put, the loss of other alternatives when one alternative is chosen. We face such choices all the time in real life. Imagine the choice between seeing a movie with your friends or studying hard to get a good grade for the examination you have the next day. The opportunity cost for studying hard is foregoing the enjoyment of the movie and spending time with your friends. However, the cost of seeing the movie is a lower grade on the exam. Next, there is the concept of time preference, introduced by Eugene Bombardier. If I offer you the choice between $100 today or $100 in 1 month's time, the chances are you'll go for the $100 today. This is your preference for having something now instead of in the future. If I offer you £10 today or $100 in 1 month's time, you might have a more difficult choice. Can you forgo the $10 now to make the $100 in a month? This would be a low time preference. If you take the $10 today, we'd say that you have a high time preference. You prefer to consume the $10 now than have $100 in a month. One of the theories for which the Austrian school is famous is their theory of the business cycle, which argues that most of the boom-bust cycles we see in the modern economy are caused by expansionary credit. This was first outlined by Ludwig von Mises in 1912 in his landmark book called The Theory of Money and Credit. Lots of people instinctively know the Austrians are correct about this, and yet very little has been done to stop boom and bust cycles in the 100 years since Mises first introduced the theory. Another famous concept introduced by Mises is the economic calculation problem. Mises argued that in the absence of a market economy, socialist systems would not know how to allocate resources effectively because they are missing prices as signals of what people want. He first argued this in his book Socialism in 1922 and would be proven correct by the collapse of virtually every socialist government in the next 80 years of the 20th century. Finally, F.A. Hayek introduced the knowledge problem. This is an extension of the economic calculation problem to include virtually all decisions made by central decision-making units. Hayek argues that the knowledge required to make effective decisions in the economy are dispersed among thousands of people on the ground, and no one person can possibly acquire the data to make even a semi-informed call as to what to do now. Probably the most accessible book on the knowledge problem was written by Thomas Sowell. It is called Knowledge and Decisions. Today, the Austrian School of Economics has split into two different branches, roughly speaking, between followers of F.A. Hayek and followers of Ludwig von Mises and his American protege, Murray Rothbard. The followers of Hayek tend to analyze real-world institutions and policies, emphasizing the misallocations of resources and avertible disasters caused by interventionism, and promoting the efficacy of the market mechanism, which produce accountability and feedback loops. The Hayekians have a stronghold at George Mason University and the Macassar Center. I've listed some of them there. The followers of Mises and Rothbard, meanwhile, are more radical in their advocacy of laissez-faire and in their opposition to the state. The Rothbardians have a stronghold at the Ludwig von Mises Institute and argue for the strongest free market positions, including their opposition to central banking and the Federal Reserve System, fiat currency as against the hard commodity money such as gold, and fractional reserve banking, which they want to abolish. Across the Austrian school, however, opinions range on how large the state should be, from minarchists and contractionists who want a limited government or a night watchman state, to full anarcho-capitalists who believe all functions would be better handled by private enterprise. The Chicago School was founded chiefly in the 1940s under Frank Knight at the University of Chicago. Knight had three extraordinary students: James M. Buchanan, who went on to found a sub-branch of political economy known as public choice; George Stigler, who wrote the seminal book on price theory, as well as developed the economic theory of regulation; and finally, perhaps one of the most famous economists of all time, Milton Friedman, who was the driving force of monetarism in the late 20th century. In contrast to the Austrian school, which, as we have seen, emphasizes human action, The Chicago School sees economics as studying the allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses. The focus on resources as opposed to people may seem minor, but it does have major consequences. One consequence is that unlike the Austrians, the Chicago School see economics as being closer to a hard science. Resources can be recorded as data. Hard data can be analysed as empirical evidence, and thus economists can study the economic effects of various policies almost like scientists in a lab. As a result of this, the Chicago School develops an almost entirely data-driven view of the world and of economics, whereas Austrian economists tend to advance their arguments a priori using reason from first principles. Chicago School economists are more likely to say things like, "Show me the evidence." Partly as a result of this nearly entirely data-driven view of the world, the Chicago School has no objections to utilizing mathematical models. The test of any model is if it can predict what happens in the real world. If the model gets it wrong, then refine and revise until it gets it right. So what contribution has the Chicago School made to economics? First, there is, of course, Milton Friedman's quantity theory of money, in which the total amount of the money supply is said to dictate real-world prices. Friedman held that central banks exacerbated the Great Depression in the 1930s by restricting the supply of money. They should have printed more, he said. He also argued that the Keynesian focus on aggregate demand was misplaced and that the government intervention should be restricted to controlling the money supply. This is in contrast to the Austrian view, which, as I mentioned, chiefly holds expansionary credit as responsible for recessions and not the supply of money. Another contribution of the Chicago School is what is typically called rational expectations. That is, when they build their models, Chicago economists assume that agents within the models are rational agents. Of course, these models have been criticized because people in the real world are not always rational. For example, let us take Gary Becker's rotten kid theorem. Imagine you have an altruistic parent who gives two siblings $10 each. One sibling is mean and decides to bully the other one. Therefore, next time the parent decides to give the victim sibling $20 and give the bully nothing. The incentives are such then that bullying is punished and being a victim is compensated. In Gary Becker's terms, the parent has transferred utility from the wrongdoer to the victim. But apply this to any real family, and can we be sure if it would have the desired effect? George Stigler's major contribution to the Chicago School is his work on regulation, and especially the phrase regulatory capture, which is the insight that once set up, regulatory bodies have incentives to grow far beyond their original remits. Again, I'd recommend the book Knowledge and Decisions by Thomas Sowell on this. Incidentally, Sowell was Stigler's doctoral student. In this book, he essentially combines Stigler's insights on regulation with F.A. Hayek's knowledge problem. James M. Buchanan's Virginia School of Public Choice, which grew out of the Chicago School, developed a robust way of analyzing the functions of government and government departments and agencies to push back against Keynesian claims of market failure by pointing out the hundreds of examples of government failure. Finally, one of the Chicago School's most lasting contributions is how they were able to turn the tools of economics to focus on topics other than trade or money. Popular examples include Hidden Order by David Friedman or Freakonomics by Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner. The Chicago School has strongholds in, where else but the University of Chicago, but also at think tanks such as the Hoover Institution in Stanford. You can see some Chicago economists listed here, and as with the Austrian School, opinions range within the Chicago School from minarchists or contractionists and those who want limited government or a night watchman state to full anarcho-capitalists. In closing, I want to review the similarities and differences of the Chicago School and the Austrian School. The Austrian school advances its arguments through a priori rationalism, taking a causal realist approach which emphasizes the role of time. The Chicago school, in contrast, advances its arguments through empirical evidence using a quantitative approach which utilizes mathematical models. In addition, the two schools differ in their view of prices. The Austrians are consistently subjective in their approach, whereas the Chicago school inherit the neoclassical view of seeing production costs as a factor in determining prices. Finally, the two schools differ on macroeconomic theory. The Austrians reject the distinction between microeconomics and macroeconomics entirely and insist that most recessions can be explained by their theory of the business cycle and expansionary credit. The Chicago school, meanwhile, follow John Maynard Keynes in considering the economy as a whole zoomed out in aggregate statistics, but differ from Keynes in their emphasis on the money supply rather than demand for goods as being the area in which government should focus their intervention. However, despite these differences, let us not forget how many similarities there are between these two schools. Both Austrians and Chicago advocates support the free market. They are generally opposed to government interventions and regulations. They are utterly opposed to socialism. Both also broadly accept Hayek's insights about the knowledge problem, which enable them to branch out in order to analyze aspects of everyday life as well as things we typically think of as economic, such as trade or money. Now, people often ask me if I'm more towards the Austrian school or the Chicago school. My personal view is that on the substantive areas of disagreement, such as on monetary policy or pricing, the Austrian school is generally correct. In fact, whenever the two schools disagree, it seems to me that the Austrian view is more consistently and rigorously argued. However, I tend to disagree with the Austrian insistence on a priori rationalism. The Chicago school ended up winning many more battles in the real world because they had the data to back them up. It's more persuasive to be backed by statistics, and I see no reason why Austrians shouldn't engage in empirical analysis of historical data themselves. They can maintain their objections to predictive models as being impossible where humans are concerned, but think about their own general theories, such as the business cycle and the economic calculation problem, which have been borne out in the real world. I mean, Mises predicted both of those things correctly. So not pointing this out with robust data analysis is to cede the ground to their opponents on issues where they should win easily. Anyway, I hope you learned something here. Now get out.
And a very special thanks to Sir Percy Blakeney, The Crimson Satyr, The Ambivalent Onion, Andy Swainson, Bailey in Aurora, David Vacherche, Christopher Scholholm, Natural Rights, Binary Surfer, Holy Spatula, Hornito Jones, Kazga, Michael Tynan, Time Stealer, Toyotomi Ami, Tragic Vision, William Angus, Blake Barrows, and Edward Darrow.